which was the 14th of, I guess, October. Okay. So that...
I thought that was last week.
Yeah, so I must have copied something wrong here. Maybe it's 9. Yeah, it didn't make sense as I was writing it. Well, some months within the last... Maybe it's not even the 14th, I'm not sure. But anyway, it is. I think the number is probably okay. And it is. If you look up Johansen and Pearson, Pearsa, then I think everyone knows about Pearsa, right? Or, yeah. So if you look it up, I think it's one of only two talks there or something. The other thing, which I think already Faye stressed a lot, is that this is not seminar, this is a lecture, a course, you know. So the most important thing is not to get through all the material, which there's no hope of doing anyway, but for people to understand whatever material we cover. So, as with Faye, so questions are more than welcome and encouraged at any point if there's something that's going past that you don't understand. So what I wanted to talk about today is kinematics and dynamics. I mean, Faye mentioned kinematics, phenomenology, and dynamics, and gave some sort of broad sweep, overview of things. I want to go into some detail on some kinematic questions, and then if there's a time, which there might or might not be, make a start on dynamics, specifically the one approach to dynamics that we call classical sequential growth. So I'll describe that in some detail, either today or tomorrow, but or some combination of the two. But I want to start with kinematics. And so by kinematics, in terms of this division, which roughly applies in some, at least in some rough form, to every physical theory, more or less. Phenomenology. In the case of causal sets, what I mean by kinematics is it is kind of a twofold thing. On the one hand, it means just understanding, I mean, a causal set is a very different kind of object than many people are used to working with. It really belongs, just as differential geometry somehow is the mathematics of classical general relativity, the mathematics of causal sets is mixture, but it's more in the area that people call combinatorics, and some of that is not so familiar. So part of the what I'm calling kinematics is just development of the mathematics proper to causal sets. But the other thing, of course, is the more physical aspect, which is how to relate it to the continuum or to the geometry. So Faye had that slogan yesterday, which was order plus number equals geometry. But what does that mean in practice? So, I mean, it's kind of a remarkable thing that something as simple and elementary in its basic structure as a partial order, which has nothing like the whole, you know, rich array of different concepts that go into a differentiable manifold, as Faye mentioned, something that simple in its essence could even be capable of giving rise to something like a differentiable manifold with a Lorentzian metric. So she gave a lot of evidence that that was the case, but how would you go about it in practice? So suppose someone gave you a causal set and they told you that it's faithfully embeddable in some space-time, how would you start working out what that space-time actually is and what are its geometrical properties? So that's a long story. A lot of work has been done on that. But the very first question that you might ask, and I should say, the very first question you might ask is one we still can't answer. That's the question, how do we know whether it is a manifold, whether it's like a manifold or not? Is it well approximated by any manifold, or is it one of these very strange causal sets that Faye referred to yesterday that I'll talk about a little bit more today? But we don't know the full answer to that. We have pieces of the answer. But suppose I tell you that it is well approximated by some manifold. How would I start reading out the geometrical properties of that manifold and topological properties from the order information? So the very first question that you could ask would be, what is the dimension of that manifold? And that came up as a peculiar exception to this Malamud version of the theorem, where you had to assume the dimension, unless you put in strong causality as an assumption, which is not unreasonable to put in. But anyway, looking at the causal set, how would we know the dimension? So that's the thing I want to concentrate on, and I'll go into some detail showing a particular estimator for the dimension, which is called the Mirheim-Meyer dimension, named after the two people who independently introduced it, Jan Mirheim that Faye mentioned last time, and David Meyer. And I'll show you how we would, the techniques by which we can analyze this dimension estimator and show in what circumstances it works, or show the extent to which it works. So, for example, if you were wanting to build, say, an 11-dimensional manifold, it's just a number I picked at random, right? So if you wanted to build an 11-dimensional manifold causal set that was like it, you couldn't probably do it with 3 points. You couldn't do it probably with 5 elements. How many elements would you really need? How many elements do you need until the notion of dimension even becomes meaningful? So we'll get a fairly definite answer to that question. I mean, not to be taken too seriously, but I think it's... And for large dimension, you can say that you need about 27/16 to the d elements, basically 2 to the d, which is about what you would have probably guessed is the best you could do. So this is a very efficient dimension estimator. And the other thing about it is some of the techniques that are used in this analysis, which the analytical understanding of this Mirheim-Meyer dimension are the same techniques that go into working out how to put a scalar field on the causal set, or specifically how to put a D'Alembertian, which hopefully Faye will talk about Friday, which has led to some of the most recent striking progress in causal sets in a dynamical nature. So this will be both an illustration of a concrete way of relating geometry to order and number, and it also develops some tools or results that will be useful and when in this particular approach to dynamics that Faye will talk about. So that's what I'm aiming at doing today. But before doing that, I want to say something about the first aspect of kinematics. Just try to make sort of people feel more familiar with posets, partial orders, which is what a causal set is mathematically, and some of the way mathematicians think about them and some of the basic concepts that one uses in thinking about them. So the most important ones, I think, are, I tried to winnow this glossary down, which was originally much longer, so to get just the key ones. So hopefully most of the important notions that I'll define are, again, repeated in that glossary with their definitions. So, the first thing I want to do is define a causal set. You've already seen the definition once or twice in terms of this order relation, which I'll either write like this or that if I'm lazy, but with one nuisance difference that'll be one different bit of a nuisance change that'll be different from what Faye did. I'll assume, in contrast what she did, I'll assume so-called irreflexive convention, which means that we will not say that an element precedes itself. So I think Faye mostly said that an element did precede itself, but she tended to use this symbol. So I won't use that sign, so it looks more like less than rather than less than or equal. And I'll always take the convention that no element does precede itself. So I won't repeat the definition that Fay gave, but I'll give some other definitions and ways of thinking about causal sets and representing them that are also useful and are commonly used in mathematics. So I'll just... So it's a causal set is a poset, which the definition was given before, and I'll just repeat it in words. It was a, in this case, irreflexive, but the important thing is transitive. Oh, actually, maybe I should write this down because there's one simplification in the statement of the axioms. If we adopt this irreflexive convention, then it's enough to say that a poset is a transitive and irreflexive binary relation, because the crucial things are transitive and acyclic, right? So transitive is a property of causality as we normally think of it. If A can influence B and B can influence C, then of course indirectly A can influence C. So transitivity is kind of built into our notion of causality. Acyclic is not so much built in, and I'll say in a little bit why, even though it's not built in, we have to build it in if we want to make contact with macroscopic geometry. That is, I'll say in a bit why, in a sense, you couldn't relax that condition in a useful way. So why you could not have closed time-like curves, so to speak, from this starting point. So anyway, causality, as we normally think of it, is transitive. We don't necessarily think that it's acyclic, but that's the most common thing. But instead of adding acyclicity explicitly, this irreflexivity implies it, right? Because if we say, when you say it's acyclic, what you're saying is that you can't have a cycle of things like A precedes B, precedes C, blah, 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 precedes A. Right? And you can narrow that down to just two, because by transitivity I can just pick on one in the middle, say C, and then by transitivity A precedes C and C precedes A. So when you rule out acyclicity explicitly, you say that this can't happen, that if A precedes C and C precedes A, that's impossible unless A equals C, and you've adopted the convention that says that an element precedes itself. But if we don't adopt that, if we adopt the opposite convention, then this can't even happen. So the fact that we rule out, so this is excluded, the fact that we adopt this convention means that we don't have to explicitly state acyclicity as one of the axioms for a poset. Okay. And then, of course, the key, the thing, this less is more, as we were saying, that the causal set is not just any partially ordered set, but it's a discrete partially ordered set. And we get the extra information on volume that wouldn't have been present in these theorems in the conformal factor if we had the continuum. Since we have a discrete object and not a continuum, we get, of course, less information in the sense that the information is more approximate with respect to a true continuum, but we get more in the sense that we can count elements and therefore have a measure of volume. So the key assumption of discreteness is that the causal set, as opposed to just any old poset, is locally finite. And sometimes we'll strengthen that, especially in the context of cosmology and these sequential growth models that I'll be talking about. We'll strengthen that to past finite, which means that no element has more than a finite number of predecessors or ancestors. That's what past finite. So you can't trace your descent, line of descent, or whatever that's called, back infinitely far. There's an earliest element, no matter how you trace back. Okay, so that's the kind of object I'll be dealing with. But this can be represented in other ways, not just in terms of order relation. So, what is an order relation? Well, you could think of it as just a collection of all the pairs, just a lookup table that tells you whether element X precedes element Y. Or you could think of it as a kind of function that, which sometimes people call a predicate. You give it X and Y, and you, this function either says yes or no, meaning either there X precedes Y or it doesn't. But there are other representations, in particular graphical representation and a matrix representation that are often used, especially if you look in the mathematical literature, you'll find the matrix representation used a lot. So other representations of causal sets are as a graph, a matrix, as a T0 topology. So the causal set is in a certain sense a topological space. It's not that we'll be using this, but if you look at some of the literature, like the paper by Kleitman and Rothschild that showed what was the generic form of a causal set, they don't say what's the most general poset or what's the generic poset. They say how do we count the T0 topologies? So the point is that there's a lot of interconnections between the notion of poset and other basic mathematical notions. In fact, poset is somehow one of the basic concepts in combinatorics. Yes.
What's T0 topology?
So I told people to ask questions. That's one question I was hoping I wouldn't get. We won't be using this at all, but it's easily answered. So by a topology, that means a topological space. So it means a space, I'm sure you're familiar with the definition, but it means a space provided with a family of open sets, or if you like, the notion of convergence. But let's say, so this is a space plus open sets. However, you could imagine some sort of degenerate cases where, by definition, the empty set is always open and the space as a whole is always open. You could imagine a degenerate case in which there are no other open sets. That would be kind of a useless space. I mean, it might have an infinite number of points, but you couldn't tell any of the points apart just from looking at the open set. Any sequence that converged to one of the points would converge to every other point, and you wouldn't be able to distinguish them from the topology. So it's, when that doesn't happen, that's called T0. So that just from the knowledge of the open sets, you can distinguish all the points from all the other points. That's what they call T0. So basically, it's a space in which there are no superfluous points. You would just have points whichever are present, whichever you have enough to support the open set, so to speak. Well, actually, what they are in the. So, I mean, I have to try to stress that these are not the things that will correspond in a natural way to open sets in space time. It's just a mathematical equivalence, but it has a different meaning. But yes, the answer. So it turns out that the answer is just the past sets. Just the past sets. Not the future ones, but the past sets. So if you had the future and the past, that would be more physically natural. That would be like this Alexandrov topology that Fay was talking about. So in the manifold, let's go back to a Lorentzian manifold, if you take the so-called chronological past, in other words, the interior of the past light cone, and you take the interior of the future light cone, then you would get a nice little open neighborhood of a point, because you can bring the two light cones together, and you recover the whole manifold topology in the case where it's what's called strongly causal, this causality condition that Fay mentioned. But in this other construction, you look only at the past sets. What it belongs to is more like a theory of coverings. I don't want to go into it too much. It's an interesting thing in itself. But it has, at best, an indirect relationship to the topology of space-time. It might be, I mean, David could tell you more about it, but it might be related more to the topology of a hypersurface. There it makes a little more sense, right? So if you imagine something like a hypersurface in the space-time, like a Cauchy surface, we'll see what that is. The analog of that is what's called a slice in the causal set. It's given, it's defined in the glossary. Then you could imagine, well, if I have all of these pasts and I just look at their shadows on the hypersurface, they might make a nice family of open sets. So there might be an indirect connection actually between this and topology, space-time topology, but not of the whole space-time, but of a slice within it or a hypersurface. And one can use that to define a kind of one can use related ideas, not literally this one so far, but one can use, or I guess it didn't work so well when you tried this so far, but one can use related ideas to give it, to read out topological information from a manifold-like causal set. Okay. So the dimension is also topological information, but it's a very elementary form of topological information, very primitive form. And this is a more sophisticated, like homology groups and so on. I won't talk about that, but that's if there's any connection here, that's where the connection lies. Is there other questions? Okay, so there's these many different definitions of a poset is. I'll always deal now with a finite poset, just to simplify things. So the main other representations are as a graph, what's called a Hasse diagram, and as a matrix. So you can easily imagine how you could represent a causal set as a matrix. So let me, if you were going to represent it in a computer, this is one of the main ways you might adopt. So that's the one David tends to adopt in his code. So let me imagine this sort of the simplest one I could think of that will illustrate this. So let's imagine it has a poset with four elements and this set of relationships. So what I've shown here is all the order relations. So this means if I call these elements sort of E0, E1, E2, in E3, what I'm trying to represent here is that E0 precedes E1 precedes E3, E0 precedes E2, and of course, since it has to be transitive, it follows that E0 precedes E3. So if I didn't omit anything, then I think I've listed here the full relation, instead of all the related pairs that define the causal set. If I represent this graphically, I would draw a line from E0 to E1, from 1 to 3, and so. And if I drew all the ones, I would also draw this line between E0 and E3. But as with the diagram that Faye showed yesterday, this one is redundant. It just clutters up the picture. So we don't bother to write it because we can deduce it by the fact that there's a path here from here to here. So this is what's called a Hasse diagram. So we don't need this line, and then by this using, this is a fortunate case where mathematicians and physicists have used the same convention, unlike the opposite convention. So, like in Hilbert spaces, they tend to use the opposite convention, which argument of the inner product has the complex conjugate on it. But in this case, it would have been a disaster if mathematicians had time going down and physicists had time going up. That didn't happen, fortunately. So time runs up by convention. Then once you make that convention, you don't really need these arrows. It's just enough to draw the graph. And that's how people usually draw it. So this then represents, this is the representation of a, this particular four-element poset as a Hasse diagram, and it's only, if we want to say as a rule how to draw this, you draw only the links, what are called the links, that is the causal relations that are not implied by the other relations. This is a special case of what's called a digraph. You might ask, so if a causal set, if a just a poset, this is a finite poset, is a digraph, that just means directed graph. Okay, it doesn't mean a dual graph or something like that. It's directed graph, a graph with arrows on it. If you ask which class of digraphs can actually be a poset, a Hasse diagram of a poset, then there's a simple answer. I'll leave it to you It's like a little homework problem if you want to check that this is right. It has to be a graph. See, the rules are that it has to be, you have to build in the fact somewhere that there are no cycles, and you have to build in the fact that there are no redundant lines, that you've drawn only the links. So when can a graph be like that? So there are two obstructions. It must not contain a graph that looks like this. In other words, a cycle. So these are excluded. And it must also not contain one that looks exactly like that, except you reverse one of the edges. So if you take any graph that contains doesn't contain either of those two types of graph as a subgraph, then it's the Hasse diagram of a poset. Okay. And the meaning, as I said, is that you haven't included cycles, and that you, so there's, you could draw it consistently on the page with upward meaning the future, and that you don't have redundant things. So there's a little theorem you could prove that any graph is the Hasse diagram of, an arbitrary graph is the Hasse diagram of some poset, if and only if it doesn't contain these subgraphs. So that's a graph theoretic way of thinking of what is a poset. The other way, that's even sort of more obvious, I'd say, is as a matrix. So if we just label the elements, the rows and columns, by the elements of the poset, and then we put a 1 when there's a relation and a 0 otherwise. So we've adopted the irreflexive convention, so E0 doesn't precede E0. In this case, E0 does precede E1, and it also precedes E3, and it also precedes E2, so I put all those. Then as far as E1 is concerned, it precedes E3, but not E2, so I put a 0 here. And then E2 precedes nothing, has no descendants, and similarly E3, which is also a maximal element. We call this, an element like that, we call a minimal element, which I think probably I didn't put in the glossary. I probably should have. This is a minimal element, so it means that it has no ancestors. It doesn't mean it's minimum. It's not the absolute lowest one. In this case, it is, but in general, you could have more than one minimum element. And if, the opposite, if it has no descendants, it's called, if it's at the top, it's called maximum. Yeah.
So in the matrix representation, you do include the...
good question. Yeah, good question. So in this one I have, there could have been two graphical ways of doing this. I could have included all the lines that related every element, or I could have used only the minimal ones, the links. The same choice is present in the case of the matrix. So here I've represented what we call the causal matrix. It represents the whole relation. But you could do the opposite thing. You could choose only to put ones for links, and that would carry the same information, as long as you're in the finite case. You see, it wouldn't work if you were doing, if you're trying to represent a space-time in that way, which is a continuum, it wouldn't work because there are no links in the space-time. Now, for any two causally related elements, there's another one in between. But in the discrete case, the links really carry all the information. So the other possibility would be to leave this out, right? So this would be left out. This we would call the link matrix. So actually, there are two graphical representations of any causal set, and there are two matrix representations, depending. In this case, they differ by only one element, one changing to a 0. But obviously, in a more general case, there would be a much bigger difference. So maybe I should define the notion of link, since I can't remember if Faye, but anyway, I'll define it again here. I think Faye actually gave it, but X precedes Y we call a link if it's irreducible, that you can't deduce it from anything else by transitivity. So that the only way you could reduce something by deduce a relation by transitivity, say A precedes B, is if there was something in between, that you and then you use transitivity. with the various things in between. If nothing is in between, then there's no possibility of deducing it. So we just say if there's no other third element, Z, such that X precedes Z precedes Y. So these are the nearest neighbor, in the causal sense, the nearest neighbor pairs. That's what we call a link. And as I said, it's another theorem. I mean, in some sense, it's obvious until you start asking yourself if you really know it, then it becomes confusing, like a lot of things. But in some sense, it's obvious that the links determine the whole thing. But if you like, you could prove a little lemma. I remember proving it to myself once when it wasn't so obvious to me, that if you know all the that there's a unique set of links, and if you know all the links, you get back the causal relation. So there's a one-to-one correspondence between posets, finite posets, defined by those axiom, wherever they were. Here it is. And this one here. And Hasse diagrams, or such link matrices. So from the one matrix, you can get to the other. So we can recover all of the relation just from the links. Also, there's one other thing that's worth noticing about this. Oops. There's one other thing that's worth noticing about this matrix, which is that there are no ones below the diagonal. Now, why is that? Well, because I chose to label this in a very particular way. I chose it so that the labels also go up. So, for example, if I had labeled this as 0 and this as 2, then the labeling would conflict with the causal order between these two elements, and I would have had a 1 somehow below the diagonal. So another little theorem that you could prove to yourself that's maybe not quite as easy is that it's always possible to do a labeling like this, even for infinite, as long as they're past finite causal sets. There always exists such a labeling. And so those labeling are very important in connection with the sequential growth dynamics that I'll talk about later. So there's a notion of natural labeling. And so that labeling order doesn't conflict with this. In other words, or if we want to say it more formally, it means that if element X precedes element Y, then the label of X must precede the label of Y. Not the converse, right? Because if that was true, you would have to define a chain, because then the elements would all be related to each other. But you never get label X preceding label of Y when Y precedes X causally. Such a labeling is always, so there's a theorem, a little lemma or a theorem, that's always possible for a past finite causal set. You can see it has to be past finite, because if there was no earlier, it's always possible for past finite to find such a labeling to label with what are called the natural numbers. In other words, just the numbers 0, 1, 2. There's another related theorem. If you're willing to use negative numbers, then you can label the causal set that's not past finite. But if we just stick with the numbers from 0, the integers from 0 onward, then we can label any past finite causal set. You can see that it has to be past finite, because I'm going to label something with 0, and then there better not be any ancestors of that, or I'll get into a conflict. Okay, is that any questions on this? Okay, so let me mention one other thing that's a little less simple-minded than some of these things, which this is an algorithm for transitive closure. So this comes up, for example, if you were actually simulating sequential growth, which I haven't defined yet, but you would have some, you'd have some relations, but you wouldn't have all the relations. They, you wouldn't necessarily have just the links either. So you wouldn't necessarily have either of these two matrices. You'd have something in between. So if I'm given some relations and I guarantee you that all the links are there, but there may be some others, but not all the relations are there, how do you find out what are the links and how do you find out what are the relations? The specific question is what's called transitive closure, which is how do I find all the relations that are implied by transitivity. Once I've got them, then it's easy to find the links just by applying this rule, just searching through for links. So there are many different algorithms for it. It's a big thing. People write their thesis on how to get a better algorithm. But there's the absolute simplest algorithm for it, which is kind of nice. And so I'll just leave it as an exercise to prove that it works. I'll represent it in kind of abbreviated form. It's a loop. It's a triple loop, right? So this is like you loop over y, and then for each value of y, you loop over all x, and for each value of x, I'm just representing it like this for all, for short. Then if x precedes y precedes z, then you have to, if it's not there already, you have to add the fact that x precedes z. If you go through that loop, it's kind of remarkable. If you go through that loop, you'll get all the relations. You go through those three loops once. I mean, you might think, well, I look through and I find some things implied by transitivity, and I add them in. Then I go make another pass, and because now I have more relations, I'll have to add more things. And if I do enough passes, I'll finish. But it turns out you only need to go to do this if you have to pay careful attention to the order here. So the one that was in the middle, the y, had to come as the outer loop. If you do, so it's kind of an interesting exercise to prove why that's true. If you do it in that specific order, then when you finish one pass of this whole procedure, you've got all the relations. So as I said, we won't be using that in these lectures as such, but if you come to do some practical programming with it, something like this will be crucial. Oh, and speaking of practical programming, I wanted to mention there are a couple of packages, computer packages, for working with causal sets if you want to play around with them. One is by John, I think it's John Stembridge, and it's written in Maple. And there's another one that I have, which is at my website, and it's written for those who know the language in Lisp. So if you're happy with either of those two languages, then you can have a lot of fun fooling around with the larger causal sets on the computer. Also, but this in... this one includes a library of all posets up to 8 or 9 elements or something like that. So, which we'll see that there are very many. So let me just make a couple of more definitions. And then, yeah. Oof, okay. Since they're in the glossary, I won't bother to write them all out. I'll just say in words. One is interval. That's a crucial concept, which Faye already used several times. Another one is past and future, which have the obvious meanings. So the these are the past of an element. This is the future of an element. So given an element x here, although I won't write them out, maybe I'll draw a picture. This is the future. This is the past of that element, all of its predecessors or ancestors. And the interval is, you know, the intersection. So this is, so if we have A and B, this is the interval that Faye wrote as I of A. No, oh, that's another conflict in notation. Faye wrote it as I of B comma A, I believe. Did you? And I muttered, I'll write it as I, A comma B. So this is a natural generalization of the interval in a line. So when we write something like A, B in the real line, you compare that. That means the real line has an order. It's a poset, but a very simple kind of poset called a chain or a linear order. And so every element is related to every other element in the real line. And then, but what we call the interval is everything that's in terms of that relation between A and B. So here, everything that's causally between A and B, we call the interval.
Do you include A?
Yeah, do we include A and B? So yes and no, right? Yes or no. And so sometimes you include both A and B, sometimes you exclude it, both A and B, according to the needs of the moment. Or you might include A and exclude B. If you want to sort of default, I'll say the exclusive interval. Meaning exclude A and B. That means if I use that, then I could define it by the set of all X such that A precedes X precedes B. Since I've used the irreflexive convention for that, that would exclude A and B. But sometimes you might like to include A and B. The other definitions are an anti-chain. Chain and the height and the width of a poset. So a chain, I think Faye defined already. So it's a set of elements all related to each other, a subset of the causal set, all of whose elements are related to each other. So if we represent it itself as a poset, it just looks like this. Its Hasse diagram looks like this. So it's called a chain. These are the links of the chain, although they might not be links of the causal set in which the chain is. And then an anti-chain is the opposite. It's kind of dust. It's a set of elements that all of which are space-like to each other. In other words, they have no causal relation to each other. And then this height and width are what are called invariants of the poset in the mathematical sense. There's numbers you can attach to the poset that depend only on its structure, that don't care how you've labeled the poset. There are two of the more important invariants of a poset. The height is just the length of the longest chain you can find in the poset. So it's the number of layers you'd have to draw if you drew the Hasse diagram. And the width is the number of elements in the biggest anti-chain. So if you think in terms of a cosmology, this is like the age of the universe or something. Or in terms of an interval, if you just took the interval as your poset, then this would be roughly the proper time, a measure of the proper time between the two endpoints of the interval. And this is kind of like proper time. Sorry, it's probably illegible. And this one is more like spatial volume. Not space-time volume, which we've been talking about all the time, but just spatial volume. I'll say three volume if we're thinking in four dimensions. So in something like a cosmology, a space-like hypersurface would be like an anti-chain, a particular anti-chain, and the number of elements would represent the spatial volume. Okay. So those are some basic concepts from causal posets. Yeah.
Is the height of the longest chain?
The longest chain, right. Okay, yeah, so because this is Lorentz, this all we have always in mind, the Lorentzian kind of geometry.
So it's like the proper time of a particular observer.
Well, it's the observer who takes the longest time to get from here to here. So, which would mean in the continuum that would be a geodesic, right? So in other words, it represents, not every geodesic is the longest path between its endpoints because of what's called focusing or caustics in the continuum. But if you don't go too far, every geodesic, if you go into one of these so-called convex normal neighborhoods that Faye referred to, then it is true that every geodesic is the longest, every time-like geodesic is the longest curve between its endpoints. And even if you go far and you allow for curvature, the opposite, the converse is always the case. So the longest curve between A and B will be a geodesic. So, and if you're in a globally hyperbolic space-time, say, there always will be a longest curve, and it'll be a geodesic. And so it's natural to call that the time-like, the proper time between those two space-time point events. And this is more just no more than the obvious translation of that into the discrete setting. But the interesting thing is how well it works. So, I mean, there were the theorems that Fay referred to also, which show you that it actually gives a very excellent approximation to, in the case where the causal set is faithfully embeddable into some portion of Minkowski space, this gives you a very excellent approximation to the proper time. Perhaps that's not so obvious, yeah. This would correspond to what's called a maximal. Only in one case, it's very easy in two dimensions, right? Because in two dimensions, you can just swap space and time. I mean, so yeah. If you swap space and time, then being an anti-chain becomes being a chain, and then you can apply those theorems. But more generally, I'm not aware of any actual theorems, but it's intuitively what you expect, because volume, what this largest anti-chain would correspond to, which we call a slice, is defined in the glossary, like that's the analog of the slice in the space-time. What that corresponds to is actually a maximal anti-chain. So in some maximal hypersurface, sorry. So again, you can see that that's a natural measure of volume when you hold the boundaries of the thing. I mean, let's not get into the whole continuum issue, but in space-times, you often want to use constant K, constant extrinsic curvature set hypersurfaces. That's not exactly this. That won't be the largest one. But if you imagine the universe and you ask, what's the absolute biggest volume that I could find anywhere in it, then you would, so like a Friedman universe, say, which looks like this, then what's the absolute biggest one? It'll be the one right in the middle, like the waist. That'll have zero extrinsic curvature, and it'll be a maximal hypersurface that we could call the volume of maximum expansion, let's say. And that would correspond to the width of the corresponding causal sets. Other questions? Okay, so this is a bunch of definitions. Now, what can we say about what can we start to say about specific and or so I'll also use the word an order. Just the word order is a synonym for poset that's commonly used in combinatorics and mathematics. So a poset of n elements is called an n order. And we can start, let's try and start understanding the structure of n orders. So the very first thing that you could ask would be, how many are there? Okay, so suppose I have, well, here we can do this collectively, probably. So let me give the number of elements, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4. So how many orders can I build with zero elements? So I guess you won't have a hard time. The only one you can build is the empty set. So there's, if we're willing to count that, let's say we count the empty set as a poset, then there's one. How many orders can we build with one element? Another hard question. If I draw a picture of it, it's Hasse diagram. What does it look? It's just a point. So just to show that it's there, I'll put a circle around it. How many can we build with two? Okay, so now we have just two elements. So there's just two possibilities. Either they're related, like this, so we get a two-chain, or they're not related, we get an anti-chain. Okay. Now how about three? Now it's getting a little more interesting. Oh, I didn't write this.
But the two, can they be related in two different ways?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. So that's an excellent question. So are we talking about isomorphism classes or what you might call unlabeled So actually what I'm counting here is unlabeled N orders. So people, or if you like, formally isomorphism classes of orders. Of course, mathematicians love to count things, and they've counted up to about 14 elements. And they've counted the labeled orders, the unlabeled orders, the naturally labeled orders. Right, if we did put labels, we could label them like this. Or let's say in this one that you mentioned. In this case, we could label it like this, but we could also label it like this if we allowed unnatural labelings, and that gives a different kind of counting. And here there are two labelings. Here it's a bit subtle, actually. In this case, there appear to be two labelings, 0 and 1. This is 1, and another one is 1 and 0. But if you look at this, this is the same thing, right? You can't distinguish, because there's, in the way that a mathematician or a physicist, I think, would count in this case, if you're just given this abstractly, then you just see one element labeled 0, one element labeled 1, and no relation. So another way of saying it is, if I represent it by its matrix, all I see is 0, 0, 0, 0. It doesn't matter how I label it, I get that same matrix. So what you're really counting there is the matrices. You could also do what you said, which is sort of imagine the elements as having some individuality and regarding these as two different ones. But then you'd really get an infinite number of orders, because I could choose another, throw these away and get another two elements, and so on and so on. So there's a lot of subtlety involved in what these numbers actually mean. But what I mean here is isomorphism equivalence classes of partial orders. So there's only two. So how about three? So what can we do for three? So any suggestions? What's your favorite three order? A chain, okay. So there's one. Anyone else have a nice anti-chain? Okay, the opposite. Okay, so we still have three to go. What else? What's that one? One chain? Like this. A two chain and an unrelated element. Yeah, so that's another one. Any other suggestions? Yeah, V, and then the time reverse, lambda or something. Yeah, so that's it. So if you can easily see, if you spend a few moments on it, that there are no others. So there are five possible unlabeled three orders. So there's five. Now, it already start becoming tedious if we try and do four orders, because it turns out that there's 16 of them. And if we try to do five orders, 63. Six orders, 318. Seven orders, 2,045. Eight orders, 16,999. Anyway, the main thing that you can see from this, let me do the nine orders. 1, 8, 3, 2, 3, 1. The main thing that you can see from this is, first of all, as I said, mathematicians like to count things. And second of all, that these numbers grow unbelievably rapidly. So how rapid, and this is some measure of how many possible causal sets there are, and also some measure of this entropic problem that Fay referred to, that you have to overcome if you're going to produce a causal order that's something like a space-time. So how many orders would you expect to find on n? Suppose, just take n elements and put them together like this in all possible ways. How many would you expect to find? I don't know that anyone has an intuition for the answer, but it turns out, I mean, you'd certainly expect them to grow at least exponentially fast, I think. It turns out that they grow even much faster than that. It turns out that the number of n orders is equal to 2 to the n squared over 4. So it's n squared over 4. So they're growing very much super exponentially. And then sub-leading terms. These subleading terms are just small numbers like n factorial and so on. Which in most circumstances tend to overwhelm the perturbation expansions and so on. So how can we see? So there, you can actually see this very simply, that there should be at least this many. Because what's the simplest kind of causal set you could make? I guess all of these, except this one, fit into that category, is what's called a bipartite or a two-layer order. So that two layers means you take a bunch of the elements, say roughly n over 2, put them in what we call the top, what you'll call the top layer, and you put another n over 2 in the bottom layer, and then you just put relations between some of these and some of these. Right? So all of these are going to be links because I'm not allowing any three chains. So it turns out, but it's not, the important thing is not that they're links. The important thing is that the choice of which relations to put here is completely free. So how many different ways can I choose these relations? Well, I have n over 2 elements here. I have n over 2 elements here. So the number of possible links that I could put in would be pick any one of these and any one of these and draw a link between it, right? So the number of possible links is just n squared over 4. If I put them all in, well, I have some particular poset. If I put them none in, I have an anti-chain. But if I make any choice in between, I get a different poset. So basically, I just have to choose a subset of the links to actually install, and that'll give me a poset. So that implies 2 to the n squared over 4 ways of choosing. Now, not all of those really produce different causal sets, because, for example, if I had, just to take a trivial case, if I had just 2 here and 2 here, I could choose to put a link there, or I could just choose to put a link here. That obviously would produce the same causal set. But that's a rare, it turns out that's a rare event when you have large n. That almost never happens. Almost every choice you make actually leads to a non-isomorphic causal set. And so this 2 to the n squared over 4 turns out to be a good estimate. So we have already on the order of 2 to the n squared over 4 two-layer orders. Then it turns out, it becomes then a very hard theorem. It turns out you do just slightly better. These subleading terms are slightly better if you use three-layer orders rather than two-layer orders. And those are called Kleitman-Rothschild causal sets. In this paper on the finite, on the T0 topologies, they prove that these are the most general, that for large n, almost all the causal sets look like this, these little three ticks of the clock universes. So a couple of other comments on I'm going to skip some things since obviously it's taking longer than hoped. So, but I do want to mention the concept of coarse graining because that's physically going to be crucial. So what does it mean to coarse grain? So if you think of a sort of a statistical mechanics system, you know, then there's block spins and there's various techniques that people have to take a fine-grained configuration, microscopic configuration, and represent it in some sort of smoothed or averaged way. And those are different methods of coarse graining. So like if you imagine a fluid like water or something and you know, each molecule has a particular location, that's the microscopic description, but when we coarse grain it, as was discussed yesterday, I mean, it was referred to, we replaced that by some smooth density function in the continuum. So the coarse graining is somehow crucial because it's the renormalization group, if you like, a fancy word. It's that technique that allows you to pass from the microscopic description which in the case of quantum gravity we're just guessing at, and the macroscopic description that we know and we have to reproduce. So what is the natural notion of coarse graining for a causal set? So the only one that seems natural is the simplest thing you could possibly do, which is selection of a subset, and then with the induced, so I wrote suborder, meaning you select a subset and then you keep the same relations that it had before, the induced relations. So it's the, then I call it a, that's why I'm calling it a suborder. It's the subset with the induced causal order. In the terms of this matrix, it just means crossing out the rows and columns of the elements that you didn't select. Okay. In the case of the Hasse diagram, it's more complicated because now things that weren't links become links and so on. So that notion of coarse graining, and normally it's nice to add, normally you would want something that in some sense is randomly selected so you get an even selection. You know, you don't want a coarse grain by, you want a uniform selection of a subset, not just to select all the ones off in some corner somewhere. So that's a notion of coarse graining, and it allows you to say things like Fay illustrated with the Kaluza-Klein spacetime with the cylinder, that a particular causal set could be two-dimensional on small scales but one-dimensional on larger scales. Okay, so I think I'll stop. Okay, so let me go now to the dimension estimators. Specifically, I suppose I should stop. This is the sort of general, this was the mathematics of something about the mathematical aspects of kinematics, the mathematics of causal sets and post sets more generally. So maybe I should stop here for questions. Okay, so let me go to the dimension estimators. So this was, so far we've just been talking about any poset, but now we're interested specifically in ones that are facially embeddable in some space-time. And specifically, even more specifically, I'll imagine, because it's the simplest case and the best understood case, that it's facially embeddable in some portion of Minkowski. In other words, it's what you might call a flat causal set. And oh, okay, so that means, I think you did. Does anyone remember? Okay, so that means that, well, I'll define it in a second. So not, more specifically, I'll do it for an interval in the causal set. So the question here is, given a causal set that we know does correspond to some portion of some Minkowski space, and taking an interval within that causal set, which I've defined before, right? All the points causally between two elements of the causal set, how would we estimate a dimension from that interval? So a space-time dimension. So faithfully embeddable meant here's the causal set, here's the manifold with its metric, and so on. This is the causal set with its order relation. This is the manifold together with its Lorentzian metric G, and it's, you know, what's the word? It obeys some causality condition, like strong causality or whatever. Say it's globally hyperbolic, let's say. I'm just drawing out globally hyperbolic. Maybe not everyone is familiar with that word, but it's just a way of saying that there's no causal anomalies. You don't have loops in it, causal loops, causal cycles, but it's somewhat stronger than that. And it also says it doesn't have holes in the middle, you haven't cut out pieces somewhere. Anyway, it's a nice regularity condition on Lorentzian manifolds. So anyone that you think of is likely to be globally hyperbolic, unless you're a string theorist, because if you're a string theorist, you're probably going to think of ADS as your first one, and that's not globally hyperbolic. But other than that, anyone that you think of is likely globally hyperbolic. So you don't have to worry. It's just a very technical point. But a faithful embedding is a mapping of C into the manifold. So here's the causal set itself, whatever. I don't know. And here's the manifold. And so to each point of the causal set, we associate each element of the causal set, we associate a point of the manifold in such a way that the order relations correspond and that these points here are uniformly distributed with density 1 in the natural units, sort of 1 per Planck volume in this manifold. That's called the faithful embedding. And the way to produce such faithful embedding, the way to produce a causal set that will faithfully embed in the manifold is to start with the manifold, sprinkle points by a Poisson process, as was described in some detail the other day, and then induce the causal order relations on the Poisson sprinkled points. Okay. So in practice, when we're working with proving theorems about this, we'll start with the space-time. In this case, we'll start with Minkowski space of some dimension d, and we'll sprinkle points in, and that'll give us our causal set. Then we'll take an interval within that and ask how we would tell its dimension. And so here's, I wanted to say something. Okay, I'll totally skip that. I'll tell you what I'm skipping. I wanted to say another reason, and Faye discussed in some detail why it should be a Poisson process. That is why these points should be look as if they were selected at random, as opposed to apparently nice or crystalline form, which turns out not to be uniform. So that's the main argument against it, that it's not truly uniform. But there's another practical thing that would probably go very badly wrong if you were to allow these, and that's what are called Umkopf processes, for those who know this word. I don't actually know what I have no idea what the literal meaning, if any, of Umklapp is. Does it have some meaning?
To fold.
To fold, I see. Oh, that makes sense, yeah. So it's a kind of folding of the Brillouin zone onto it. Anyway, it's a process that can happen in a crystal in which momentum is apparently not conserved. And energy, if you had a crystal in space-time, energy would be apparently not conserved. And that would be... And the knot conservation could be very, very big. So people who make regular kind of things like cellular automata, I'm thinking of Gerard de Tooft especially, because he's always working on, he's always having problem with this non-conservation of energy, which comes from the crystalline structure. But if you have a more fluid-like, not crystalline structure, then arguably, and I believe, the problem goes away. So that was just a side,
One of the reasons that, like, this was said earlier, go the other way and take an arbitrary coset and find a manifold.
It wasn't.
It will faithfully embed it to me.
Well, so ask yourself, what manifold would you faithfully embed this into? So if you put. So, but nevertheless, although I answered it that way, the answer is yes if you put no condition on the manifold. If you put no condition whatsoever on the manifold, then you could always find some really screwy looking, manifold that this would quote-unquote faithfully embed into. So usually, but no one would ever take that seriously. So in this Hauptvermutung and so on, which is the statement that the causal set determines the manifold uniquely up to small fluctuations, you want to put some further condition on the manifold, which is that it itself not have structure on small scales. So if you go back and think of for example, our favorite fluid example, you're going to say, for every fluid, for every arrangement of the molecules, could I find some density function that would describe it? The real answer is no, because, if you have some completely crazy arrangement of very heavily, many packed into a tenth of an angstrom, and then you have them completely spread out, there's really no... or even something like a shock wave, you're going to have trouble. There's no physically sensible distribution function that'll define that. But you could always make one up and put a bunch of delta functions here and so on, and that'll be distribution. But we wouldn't regard that as a useful fluid description of the continuum description of the fluid. And the reason you wouldn't is that your density function is varying on the atomic scale, and that just doesn't make sense. What we call the density is meant to be an average over many atoms. So you want to put a condition on the density function that it vary slowly on atomic scales. And so we put a similar condition here on these spatial embeddings, that the manifold, that the manifold have no structure on small scales. It shouldn't have, you know, Planck scale curvature. Its curvature should be much less. Then it's certainly not true that every causal set can embed faithfully in some manifold.
So does that process kind of single out a metric up to a control factor?
No, totally. So that's the key point is that it singles out the metric with the conformal factor. That's this less is more thing. That's this thing. Well, I think you weren't maybe there when Fei mentioned it yesterday, but Riemann's original remarks on that might have even been after the course. I don't remember. But this is somehow the key point, that when you have a discrete manifold, what Riemann called a discrete manifold, the volume information is inherent, together with the other metric information, is inherent in the structure of the manifold itself. And in particular, the one you're asking about, the volume information, is there from counting. So we get the volume of a region of space-time is the number of elements of the causal set that compose that region. Just like when you measure, if you want to count the number of atoms in a copper bar, then you can weigh it, right? But what its weight is secretly doing is just counting the number of atoms. And in that same sense, once you know the weight of the copper, right? So in the same sense, once you know the weight, once you know the fundamental volume, which evidence points towards the Planckian volume, then what we measure physically with rulers and clocks and so on is indirectly counting the number of elements. That's the idea. And of course, the causal order, the metric conformal structure, that's coming from the order. So everything, I don't know if it was here, this order plus number, but everything is supposed, there it is, everything is supposed to come, including the volume information. That's why we demand faithful means uniformly distributed with density 1. That's how it gets in mathematically. Okay.
Do you need to have the manifold compact, or that you're just looking at a
No, you don't. I mean, Minkowski, you can sprinkle all of Minkowski space. But what I'm going to look here is actually the dimension of I'm going to associate a dimension. For this dimension estimator, we will need a finite causal set, suborder, a finite subset of the causal set, and we'll do that by taking an interval, which by the definition of local finiteness, every interval will have a finite number of elements. So here will be the definition. So it's kind of interesting that this works. So given a causal set like this, which we made, say, by sprinkling into Minkowski space, and we fix two elements, A and B, and we take the interval, you could imagine different kinds of estimators. This is one of the class of estimators that you might call fractal dimensions. By fractal, I don't mean anything fancy. I don't mean anything more than just saying that it can assume any number. It doesn't have to be an integer by its definition. It can give a fractional answer. In general, it will give. But our task is to show that when the number of elements is large, that it will converge very rapidly to the true dimension of the manifold. So this is basically just, the rule is to, I mean, the underlying thought is to deduce the dimensionality from what's called the ordering, what Jan Mirheim called the ordering fraction of the manifold. So what does that mean? So it means if we have, suppose that this interval contains n elements, not counting the n, initial and final elements, A and B, suppose it contains n elements, then how many relations could I have between those elements if all possible relations were present? Well, that's easy enough to see. For each pair, you can have a relation. You can't have two relations. It can't go both ways because that would violate the acyclicity. So the maximum number you could have is n choose 2, which is n times n minus 1 over 2. But then the actual number, say you actually have r relations, that is, r pairs of elements which are causally related to each other, and the rest, The remaining of the n choose two will be then space-like. So if you have R relations, then the ratio of these two things, R over n times n minus 1 over 2, is called the ordering fraction. So the ordering fraction is 1 when every element is related to every other element for a chain, and it's 0. Oh, I already wrote it, ordering fraction. It's 0 if no element is related to any other element, which is an anti-chain. And the reason, the intuition behind this dimension estimator is that the ordering fraction decreases with dimension. So if you think of that's pretty easy. It's pretty easy to make that seem true to yourself. If you start with one-dimensional Minkowski space, that's no more than a line, right? Just a time-like line. And if you now imagine sprinkling points into the Minkowski space to make a causal set, in fact, if you embed them in any way at all, if you embed n elements, they're clearly all related to each other. So you're getting an ordering fraction of 1. On the other hand, if I take a two-dimensional interval, like here, then there are already going to be some pairs that are related and some that are not related. And in fact, because 2 is so simple, because of the duality between space and time that's present in 2, you can see that there'll be, what if you swap the notion of space and time, then everything that was a relation will become an unrelation, and everything that wasn't a space-like pair will become a time-like pair. So it's clear that on average you'll get the same number of related and unrelated pairs of elements. So the ordering fraction for two dimensions is obviously going to be 1/2. And then if you think in three dimensions, right, which I haven't drawn too well here, 2 + 1 dimensions, then you can see what's happening. Space is spreading out, so there are more and more ways to get unrelated pairs. So you might not be surprised to hear that the ordering fraction falls monotonically with dimension. And we'll see exactly how it falls. We'll derive a formula for it. And that's the basis of this Mirheim-Meyer dimension estimator. So just to avoid having this 2 hanging around, I think if I were to do it again, I would leave the 2. But anyway, to avoid having the 2 hanging around, I'm going to work with twice the order, or half the ordering fraction. So it's the number, it's the ratio of the number of relations to n times n minus 1, where n is the number of elements in the interval. And now what we want to do, to use this as a dimension estimator, what we want to do is to first of all find out what's the expected value of this ordering fraction in an interval of dimension n. So we'll now be doing this in n-dimensional Minkowski space. And then, but if we want to know how good the estimator is, it's not enough just to know its mean. We need to know something about the fluctuations. So if we just have one interval and one causal set, and we get a number, we don't know how reliable that number is until we know the fluctuations. So the other thing we have to do is estimate the variance or the standard deviation in this. So I want to estimate the expectation value of phi squared. So that's the calculation that I want to do now. So maybe I should just set it up. We can't get too far out of it. I can write down at least the, we can do the mean already, certainly. So here's the picture. Here's the picture. I'll draw it as if it was in three dimensions. So we started with three-dimensional Minkowski space, in general, n-dimensional Minkowski space, sprinkled points selected at an interval. I'll use always a standard interval, which is sort of 0, from t equals 0 to t equals 1. I'll call this height of this interval in the continuum sense, just the proper time between this and this, I'll just call t. We'll need a couple of formulas for the volume So what, of course, the volume is going to scale as the height. So, sorry, let me not confuse. I will be using an interval between 0 and 1, but we'll also be considering subintervals. So for this formula, let me just consider an arbitrary interval. Height t, so that's the proper distance between the top vertex and the bottom vertex. So of course, we're in n dimensions. We're in m sub n. So the volume scales as t to the n, but there's a particular coefficient that will be needed, and that's equal to, if you work it out, pi over 4 to the n minus 1 over 2 over n times n minus 1 over 2 factorial. Okay, we'll need that later. You can, I mean, as a side, there's some formula which I never can quite remember, but I think it might be, this, you just get this basically from the formula of a ball in D dimensions, and the formula of a ball in, will be spatial in this case, but the formula of a ball in D, the volume of a ball in D dimensions is, I think it's, well, maybe, pi over 2 to the D over D factorial. Anyway, there's some simple formula that you can look up that gives you the volume of a ball in D dimensions. If you plug that in and use sort of half the base times the height and all these nice geometrical things, you'll get this formula. So now let's see, how do we find, and so I'm going to now consider a Poisson-like process in which I sprinkle exactly n points into this interval. So just to simplify the thing, instead of thinking of a strict Poisson process in which the number of points in this interval would be itself Poisson distributed, it's just slightly simple mathematically to fix the number at n, and this is not going to make any significant difference when n is large. And you can prove that. So I'll sprinkle a fixed number of points into this, and now we'll just count. Let define phi as this ratio, the ordering fraction, and let's, with respect to the sprinkling, and I sprinkle another, the sprinkling process, I want the mean of this fraction phi. That is, I sprinkle it once, I compute phi, then I throw it away, I sprinkle it another time, I compute phi. In that way, I get an ensemble of values of phi. What's the mean of phi? So we want to find, that's what we want to find. Let me just set it up, the calculation. So what we're going to do is write phi as a sum of numbers of random variables. This is a crucial, actually, step for all of these kind of calculations. We're going to write phi as a sum of random variables, each of which is either 0 or 1. And then we just add them all up. That's phi. And divide by n. Sorry, we're going to write r as that, the number, count the number of relations. And then we'll take the mean of each one, and that'll be the, give the mean. So what are these random variables? So imagine dividing the whole thing up into tiny little regions, little rectangles, or whatever you like. It doesn't matter. Just so small that the probability of any 2 points landing into the same region is negligible, and you can neglect it. And once they're that small, it doesn't matter how much smaller you take them. So I'll call these regions dx, little bits of the interval. And I'll define a variable, chi of dx dy, which is just asking, is there a link between a sprinkled point in dx, let me call this one dx, and a sprinkled point in dy? In other words, is dx to the past of dy, first of all, so that there can be a relation, and second of all, did I actually sprinkle something into dx and dy? Obviously, the answer is going to be, most of these are going to be 0, but some won't. So that's equal to 1 if dx, or let's just say call it x, is to the past of y, and dx and dy are occupied, otherwise 0, right? So this is a random variable. It's random variable because when I redo the sprinkling, it may have a different value. So will in general have a different value. But if I add up these, if I add up all some all of these random variables over all possible pairs dx dy, obviously, by the way it's been defined, that's just equal to R, right? I mean, this is the key thing. So let me stop here and see if everyone is happy with that statement. Okay, so if you're happy, then I can take the mean, and then we can. Yes?
You're in n-dimensional.
Yes.
There should be a dx in each dimension. Is that?
Oh, I could have called this dnx or something, if you like. Is that what you mean? These represent little volumes.
Oh. Okay.
This dx is just shorthand for a small portion of the interval of the Minkowski space.
Oh, I see. Not somehow orthogonal?
Not at all. No, no. That was, I should have drawn them this summer.
Okay.
But just is any tiling, so anything that fills this up, any way whatsoever. The point is, it won't matter. You'll see this will pass over to an integral in a second when we take the limit of the size going to zero, and then it won't matter. Okay. So what? So now we can do. Now we can use this amazing theorem of of probability theory. That I mean, is that the sum, the mean of a sum of random variables is the sum of the means, right? Which is one of these things that you don't think twice. But if you do think twice, it's kind of mysterious because these things are not at all uncorrelated. Right? I mean, they're highly correlated. If there's a link, if there's elements sprinkled someplace, they're less likely to be in other places, and so on. So it's a complicated set of correlations, and that's, they're going to come back and bite us when we have to compute the variance. But when we just need the mean, we have this amazing theorem. So it's just the sum over all these pairs of intervals, pairs of plaquettes, or what's the higher dimensional analog of a plaquette? I don't know. Anyway. All we have to do now is find what's the expectation value of one of these random variables, chi of dx dy. So what is it? The expectation value of chi of dx dy. So chi of x was a number that was either 1 or 0, right? So its expectation value is just the probability that it's 1, right? Because its expectation value is the probability of it's 1 times 1 times plus the probability that it's 0 times 0. So it's just the probability that it's 1. So we have to ask how likely it is, given that dx and dy are related, how likely is it, I mean, that given that, you know, this is in the causal past of this, how likely is it that we sprinkled an element here and an element here? So what's the probability to sprinkle an element? Say we sprinkle the first element here. Okay. Well, by the definition of the Poisson process, it's just the density times the volume itself. The density is the total number of elements. I'll call V the total volume of the whole thing. This V here, right? So it's just the number of elements per unit volume times the volume of this little thing. Now we've used up one, so if we did sprinkle it, so conditional on that, then we have only N1 left. So we have, the first one, the probability of getting the first one in is just, what am I saying? Yes, I think so. Then we've used one up, so the probability of getting the second one in is n minus 1 over v times dy, which is just equal to n times n minus 1 times what you might call dx over v times dy over v. I didn't quite, yeah.
But for it to be 1, you also need that x precedes y.
And we also need that x precedes y, exactly. So let me introduce a notation I like to use. This is a symbol that's one when the condition is satisfied and zero otherwise. So it's just a selector that picks out only the pairs of points where x precedes y. So this is not a random variable. This is just some geometrical thing that depends only on x and y. So that function gives us the expectation value of this indicator thing. And now I just have to sum these over dx, over all the dx's and dy's. When dx and dy go to zero, then the sum turns into an integral. And so that the so we take some limit here of the sum, and then we get n times n minus 1 times a double integral dx dy dx over b dy over b. And that now I have to include this thing that you meant. I have to include this condition. Let me just write it as a condition on the integration variables now. So it's over all pairs such that dx, so not to use this possibly obscure symbol in the final answer. So it's just the integral over all pairs of points within the interval where x precedes y, essentially just of the volume. I mean, it's just these v's are just constants. So you're just asking to do a double integral over all pairs of points in this particular region. Oh, I don't need them. Yeah, that'll come up later, and it'll be zero. So I don't need this twice. Yeah. I mean, something like that'll come up later. We'll have dx squared times dy. But yeah, thanks. Yeah. So this should—it's just this double integral. So we just need. I'll tell you. I'll give a name to this integral here. I've run out of space. Well, I can do it. I'll give a name to this integral. I'll call it I for integral of a two-chain, because this is really it's just an integral of volumes, but it's restricted to the subset of pairs such that the two pairs make a two-chain. There are other integrals like this that we'll be able to define by strict analogy that look like this and so on. And those integrals will be needed to compute the expectation value of phi squared, the variance. But this one suffices. And that has a particular value. I'll just tell you what it is. I'll say this more starting off next time. Oh, forget that one. So this particular one equals just 3/4 times 3n over 2 choose n inverse. So it's some combination of, I mean, I'll show you how to derive it next time. It's not difficult. But anyway, that's the answer. So the ordering fraction, the expectation value of phi, which is the expectation value of r divided by n times n minus 1, this goes away, and you're just left with this number. It equals this thing, this integral that I've just defined for you, which is this thing. Then if you look at how this behaves, if you plot it as a function of n, of course, we only really need it for discrete values of n, but you can define it for anything. It falls off something like that monotonically. And so if you know this ordering fraction to a sufficient accuracy, if the error bars are not too big, then you can work back to what dimension this is and this is phi. You can work back to what dimension you have. So the next thing is to find the size of the error bar. So we'll do that next time, and we'll see how many elements you need in the causal set before the error bars become small enough that you can tell one dimension from another dimension.
So what you said earlier, I didn't want to press for the figure that you probably already said before, or was it on the book? The causal second continues in terms of
entropy. Yeah.
I think I'm still missing something, because, I mean, I can definitely see that the causal set will determine the causal structure.
Yes.
And the causal structure, you can get the measurement to conform a fractal. So how do you get to conform a fractal? I mean, I can almost see the total volume, but there's more...